colleague, he has a misunderstanding of the war. It's not only Russia and Ukraine in the war, it's a proxy war and a civil war. And to say the whole responsibility lies by Russia, these underestimate the development to the war, and I think this is a really big mistake not to see what's happening with the Minsk agreement and why our chancellor and Macron was lying about the Minsk agreement and don't want to make it. So I think it is really very much too easy to say that the whole responsibility lies by Russia.
Rhonda Brown, we're going to have to leave it there. We thank you so much, former executive director of the International Peace Bureau, and Auta Harjanne, a Green member of parliament in Finland. I'm Amy Goodman Juan Gonzalez.
This is Norma Sylvester, the boogie cat. Meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Trump arrives in New York court to face 34 charges related to hush money payments during his 2016 campaign. Three Tennessee Democratic state representatives face expulsion for supporting gun control protesters. And in international news, the latest IPCC report paints a dire picture for nations to handle the climate time bomb. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 4th, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. Former President Donald Trump was arraigned today in New York City. He was fingerprinted and sat before a judge as the 34 charges against him were unsealed. Trump faces charges related to illegal hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels to suppress negative stories in his first presidential run. All of the charges are related to records kept at the Trump Organization. Prosecutors allege that Trump was part of an illegal pattern of business payments to suppress negative information and undermine the integrity of the 2016 election. Trump pled not guilty to all charges, and his lawyers say they'll fight to get the charges dropped. The trial may not be scheduled for months, and until then, lawyers for both sides are expected to argue the merits of the case and what evidence can be presented to a jury. Republican leaders in the Tennessee legislature are attempting to expel three elected lawmakers who stood in solidarity with gun control protesters. On March 30th, around 1,000 peaceful protesters marched on the state capitol in Nashville calling for gun control in the wake of a deadly mass shooting at Covenant School in Nashville on March 27th. Three lawmakers, Representatives Justin Jones of Nashville, Gloria Johnson of Knoxville, and Justin Pearson of Memphis, joined the demonstration and used a bullhorn on the House floor podium to lead chants in protest. They were not recognized to speak at the time, which is against House rules. On Monday, as more gun control protests took place outside the Tennessee Capitol, House Republicans filed resolutions to have these three lawmakers expelled from the House. On TikTok, journalist David Heath spoke with Representative Justin Jones of Nashville, one of the lawmakers who has been threatened with expulsion, about what actions the legislature has taken against them so far.
So three of us lawmakers who stood with our constituents demanding that they take action, and hear that thousands of people gathered on Thursday talking about the crisis of mass shootings. We've been kicked off our committees as representatives elected by our constituents. Each of us represents 78,000 people, and our people are being silenced because they're kicking us off committees. They're threatening to take a vote to expel us today. Our member ID badges have been shut off. Our representative ID badges have been shut off. And this is not what democracy looks like. You know, we are elected to serve our constituents, and I'm the youngest Democratic lawmaker here, the most diverse district, and by shutting me down, they're shutting down the voice of my constituents. And they wouldn't even let us speak for our people. They wouldn't let us talk on the floor. They shut our microphones off. They shut our voting machines off. We couldn't even talk about the issue. And so when we went to the well to force the issue, they called us insurrectionists and are now trying to expel us from the legislature.
That was Tennessee Representative Justin Jones of Nashville speaking on TikTok about Republican leadership's attempts to remove him and three other elected legislators from the House. After the Republican leadership passed the resolutions to vote to expel the lawmakers on the House floor Monday, protesters chanted "fascists" from the gallery above. All three resolutions passed in a party-line vote, and since Republicans have a supermajority in Tennessee, Democrats will have little power to block the expulsions. Some Republicans have sought to characterize last Thursday's peaceful protests as a January 6th type insurrection, but The Tennessean reports that, quote, no demonstrators broke into the Capitol, no one was arrested or injured, and no property was damaged, end quote. The vote to expel the three House members is expected to take place on Thursday. Should these Democratic House members be expelled by the Republicans, it will leave 210,000 Tennesseans in the most diverse districts in the state without representation until their county commission appoints someone to fill their seats. Lolita is an orca whale who has been kept in captivity for over 50 years in Miami. Now there's a chance for her to return home in Washington's Puget Sound. Only one captive orca whale has been returned into the wild, and that attempt was unsuccessful. Keiko, the star of the movie Free Willy, was returned to his native Iceland after a long term of captivity in a tank in Mexico City, but he failed to adapt to the wild and died a few years later. Advocates hope the experience with Keiko will help them better their plans for Lolita's return. By the early 1970s, at least 45 Northwest orcas had been delivered to theme parks around the world. Lolita is the only one still alive. Those roundups reduced the Puget Sound resident orca population by about 40% and caused major problems with inbreeding. Lolita, now 57, spent decades performing. The 5,000-pound whale lives in a tank 80 feet by 35 feet and 20 feet deep. Whales are intelligent social creatures, and activists have long dreamed of returning Lolita to her home and family. The plan is to bring Lolita to a netted whale sanctuary measuring about 15 acres in the Puget Sound. She would be released into an enclosure the size of a couple football fields within that sanctuary, where she would be under round-the-clock care. It's not clear whether she can truly learn to hunt and rejoin her family. Because the southern resident orcas are endangered, advocates would have to obtain additional permits if they ever wanted to fully return Lolita to the wild. They would likely have to show that introducing another hungry whale needing to feed wouldn't burden the population further. Moving a 2.5-ton whale is difficult and could actually take 2 years. Lolita will be placed on a stretcher, lifted by crane into a tank, placed on a truck, and then delivered to a cargo plane. She'll be flown to Washington, loaded onto a barge, floated to the sanctuary, and lowered by another crane into her new home. Her transportation tank will be filled with fresh water. Salt water could ruin the plane in the event of a leak. Caregivers will need to protect her skin with ointment. Howard Garrett is the president of the board for the Orca Network. He said, quote, "It'll be therapeutic for her, and she'll get healthier. This is a step towards righting a great wrong that humans have done," end quote. Washington State's Cap and Invest program raised $300 million in its first auction for permits to emit carbon. Now they're ready to invest. KBOO's Harper Simone has the details.
Washington State's Cap and Investment program has held its first carbon auction and is getting ready to invest these funds in climate action. The auction raised $300 million and all its permits for emitting carbon sold out. The funds will go to projects like building clean energy and reducing emissions from buildings and transportation. Kelly Hall with the nonprofit Climate Solutions says the success of the auction is a good sign.
This auction shows that there's a strong market and that we can anticipate significant investments in future biennia as well.
Washington's auctions will take place 4 times a year. At least 35% of the revenue collected will go toward profits that benefit communities disproportionately affected by pollution. Which projects are funded will become clear once state lawmakers settle on a budget toward the end of the session this month. David Mendoza is with the Nature Conservancy in Washington. He says the state is looking to link up with other cap and trade markets, including in California and Quebec. But he notes key restrictions will guide that process.
If we link markets, there has to be analysis of whether linking will have a negative impact on overburdened communities in either jurisdiction. So not just Washington considerations, but what would be the impact on communities in California as well?
Hall says it's an exciting time to live in Washington as this program starts up.
We are on the brink of actually seeing a lot of these benefits, and right now it's up to the legislature to make sure that communities can actually feel the benefits of clean energy and that we're directing these investments to communities so that clean energy is accessible and affordable to all.
The Cap and Invest program is designed to help Washington State meet its climate goals. Lawmakers have set a goal to cut carbon emissions 95% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. For KBU News and the Public News Service, I'm Harper Simone.
Wisconsin's Supreme Court race will decide the future of abortion in the state. Former President Donald Trump heads to New York to be arraigned. And the director of the ATF calls for more action to keep people safe from assault weapons. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think that's a tragedy because that's not what Wisconsin used to be like. We used to have a reputation for having one of the most impartial, least corruptible court systems in the country.
Jay Heck with Common Cause Wisconsin is one political expert who feels the highly contested race for a Wisconsin Supreme Court seat has damaged the court's potential for impartiality. At $42 million, it's the most expensive race of its kind. Heck blames the loosening of the state's campaign finance reform laws. This election could change the court's ideological leaning for the first time in decades and could lead to policies that have benefited Republicans being overturned. The court is expected to hear cases challenging the state's pre-Civil War abortion ban and another challenging Republican-drawn redistricting maps. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump is in New York to be arraigned by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. His Republican allies are calling for investigations into District Attorney Alvin Bragg. Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, notes this case differs from other potentially more severe legal actions Trump is facing.
Those, I think, are more important, obviously, for him, because I think the consequences would be greater, but more important for the nation, because those are about actions that took place while he was president. Those are about actions that took place when he was supposedly protecting the nation and putting the nation first.
In the wake of a shooting at a Nashville private school, President Biden has renewed calls for Congress to pass an assault weapons ban. But Republicans have been staunchly against any gun limitations. Stephen Dettelbach, director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, agrees there isn't enough being done to prevent mass shootings from happening so often.
We haven't done enough yet. There's a lot of different measures that we need to think about and debate and decide which ones we can adopt and then send them to us and we'll implement them. That's our job at ATF, not to make the decisions, but to implement them.
Advocates are calling on the General Assembly to pass the Connecticut Voter Rights Act, which would provide new legal tools to fight discriminatory voting rules, expand language assistance for voters with limited English, and adopt strong protections against voter intimidation. Jess Zaccanino, policy counsel with the ACLU of Connecticut, calls this a necessary bill.
The Connecticut Voting Rights Act comes in response to the slow chipping away at the Federal Voting Rights Act by the Supreme Court. So this basically would guarantee the protections of the Voting Rights Act in Connecticut while also expanding the scope of that federal legislation.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you?
Well, they're two.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with the Partnership for Safety and Justice about their 2023 legislative agenda and upcoming Advocacy Day on April 19th. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds continue with a daytime high of 52. Today in history, in 1968, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. The quote of the day is from King 1 year earlier in his Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence speech. He said, quote, America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. End quote. The Veterans Administration, or VA, will waive health care copays for Native veterans backdating to January of 2022. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The VA is waiving copays for American Indian and Alaska Native veterans. The Department of Veterans Affairs announced Monday that eligible Native veterans are no longer required to make copayments for health care or urgent care received through the VA. Under the new policy, the VA will reimburse copays paid on or after January 5th, 2022. And starting Tuesday, April 4th, veterans can submit documents to qualify for the copay exemption. VA officials say eliminating copays will help make healthcare more affordable and accessible for Native veterans. Those interested in taking part in the new rule need to fill out a VA tribal documentation form. According to the VA, this is estimated to impact about 25,000 Native veterans. More information can be found online at va.gov. The U.S. Assistant Secretary for Health for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services met with students at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas late last week. Admiral Rachel Levine, an advocate for LGBT medicine, is working with the Indian Health Service on LGBTQ+ issues. One challenge, says Dr. Levine, is lack of data within IHS.
We are trying to ask the Indian Health Service to collect sexual orientation, gender identity data. Now that would be solely on a voluntary basis. So if you don't want to answer, you don't have to answer. But without asking the questions, you don't know. And there are specific ways to respectfully ask the questions. And to ask it in ways that people have flexibility in terms of how they answer.
Dr. Levine says the data would help in providing care. Dr. Levine is the first openly transgender federal official confirmed by the U.S. Senate. The Indian Health Service is a division within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. North Dakota is home to a tribal college that's successful in conserving energy. The success is a reflection of overcoming colonialism and gaining access to key resources, according to the school. Turtle Mountain Community College sits in the heart of the Turtle Mountain Reservation. Facilities manager Wes Davis is leading an effort to lower the energy bill of the college by 300%. He did this through controlling the 256 geothermal heating and cooling pumps in the school, each equipped with their own sensor. Davis says colonialism has imposed a worldview on indigenous people that has impacted how they sustain themselves. He suggests that includes access to advanced infrastructure.
We need to be able to understand how to develop our power, our energy, and how to get it to our communities.
In this particular area, Davis says the obstacles largely stemmed from Native populations being excluded from rural electric cooperatives. But he says there's now some positive movement in easing that tension, with tribal communities expressing interest in establishing their own co-ops. Davis hopes that what the school has been able to accomplish eventually leads to lower energy costs for indigenous communities surrounding the campus.
I wanted our community to be healthier and a better quality of life for them and not have to be taxed all winter long about worrying about, are they going to be able to come home to a warm home?
Davis not only wants the college to be sustainable, he wants it to teach the community and inspire residents to build more energy efficient homes. A future goal for Turtle Mountain Community College involves a vocational HVAC program and solar and renewable energy schooling. This story was produced with original reporting from Jessica Plants from Homegrown Stories in collaboration with the Solutions Journalism Network. And the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe's Be Well program we told you about on Monday was all just for fun. Happy April Fools. As we kick off the month, be well. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Proposed legislation in Oregon would require public construction projects to use iron and steel that was produced in the United States. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Oregon lawmakers could bring more iron and steel manufacturing stateside. Building on requirements to buy from American manufacturers and last year's infrastructure law, Oregon legislation would require iron and steel from the United States for public construction projects. Lauren Bowling with Iron Workers Local 29 in Oregon says the measure will cut down on the amount of imported iron and steel coming into the country.
We really see this as a coalition between labor and environmental groups as we fight for American jobs and a better focus on American and domestic manufacturing.
Opponents of the measure say it will lead to higher costs for public projects. House Bill 3332 has bipartisan sponsors in Salem. It passed out of the House Committee on Business and Labor and is currently in the Ways and Means Committee. Ron Rogers is with United Steelworkers District 12, which covers the Northwest. He says a measure such as House Bill 3332 would have helped local steel facilities on recent projects, such as a highway bypass near Newburgh.
We could have saved a lot of money on transportation costs, and the tax dollars would have stayed in the Oregon economy versus importing steel from out of country where we get no tax dollar benefit from the workers whatsoever. And frankly, it was made a lot cleaner than any processes that you're going to see out of China or other imported steel countries.
Oregon Policy Manager for the Blue-Green Alliance, Ranfis Villatoro, says this legislation complements the infrastructure's law's incentives for buying U.S.-made goods.
By passing Buy America legislation now in Oregon, we're taking advantage of and leveraging historical investments and saying, hey, we as Oregon want to be a leader in manufacturing, and we're going to also leverage our public spending to align with this historical investment to shore up manufacturing.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Starting July 1st, Georgia's Senate Bill 140 bans doctors from giving hormone treatments, puberty blockers, or surgery to transgender kids. Healthcare experts and LGBTQ supporters say the bill harms the mental well-being of trans youth and interferes with parents' rights. Shantia Hudson reports.
New legislation in Georgia targeting gender-affirming health care for transgender minors has health professionals and LGBTQ+ advocates on high alert. Set to take effect on July 1st, Senate Bill 140 prohibits doctors in Georgia from offering hormone therapy, puberty blockers, or surgery to transgender youths. Isabel Otero from the SPLC Action Fund asserts that it poses a direct threat to a vulnerable group of Georgians and infringes on parental rights and medical decision-making.
Georgia families deserve privacy and respect when it comes to personal health care decisions, and these decisions should be between the families, their medical providers, and without any political interference.
The bill's proponents argue that it is necessary to protect children from making irreversible decisions about their bodies. However, health professionals point out that gender-affirming care is not a decision made lightly, and it is only provided after extensive evaluation by medical experts. Advocates say Senate Bill 140 goes against recommendations from major medical organizations, such as the American Medical Association and the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. Stacey Fox with the Georgia Budget and Policy Institutes adds that the measure also threatens to worsen the state's healthcare worker shortage. With only 3 out of 159 counties equipped to care for their residents, attracting and retaining medical professionals becomes even more difficult.
Criminalization of healthcare providers, as research shows, has led to less people applying to medical schools in those states and a migration of current providers to states without criminal penalties.
Organizations such as Georgia's ACLU are taking a strong stance in protecting and advocating for civil liberties and rights. Focused on leveraging legal action, they're exploring all possible avenues. Recent data from UCLA reveals more than 18,000 transgender youths have felt the impact of legislative bans that were enacted in Georgia and 5 other states. For Georgia News Connection, I'm Shantia Hudson.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a dire report recently. The climate time bomb is ticking. How can the world limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius? Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The odds are against us. That's the bottom line in the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on Global Warming, the most comprehensive scientific report to date. Once again, we're told that 2030 is the year of living dangerously, when humanity must cut greenhouse gas emissions in half and then proceed to stop them altogether by 2050. Otherwise, the planet faces all the climate catastrophes we're already seeing. The climate time bomb is ticking, says the UN Secretary General. The rate of temperature rise in the last half century is the highest in 2,000 years. Concentrations of carbon dioxide are at their highest in at least 2 million years. The chances of holding global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade, which scientists tell us is the aim if we're to survive these catastrophes, are very small. The planet has already warmed to 1.1 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, and every year we see heat records being set around the world. Another major part of the problem is national interests. Governments will violate their pledges on climate change whenever their economies need pumping up, such as China's decision to permit 168 new coal-fired power plants to be built, or the U.S. decision to go ahead with the Willow oil drilling project in Alaska. Then there's the refusal of populations, especially in the richest countries, to change their habits. We want more plastic packaging, more air conditioning, more access to food from far away, more oil and gas, more lumber from old forests, etc. Climatologists are not saying that the world will end as we approach 2 degrees centigrade of warming. What they are saying is that living conditions for nearly everyone will be profoundly affected by changes in weather, including health and safety for many millions of people and other species. We're all aware of what those changes will probably be, but they are regularly updated, invariably with worse news than before. Here are just a few examples from that report. The rich-poor gap in greenhouse gas emissions continues to grow. The 10% of households with the highest per capita emissions contribute 34 to 45% of global consumption-based household greenhouse gas emissions, while the bottom 50% contribute only 13 to 15%. Or this one on food and water security, which is endangered. Roughly half of the world's population currently experience severe water scarcity for at least part of the year. As many as 2.4 billion people will experience water scarcity by 2050, and millions more will not have access to safe sanitation in water supplies. A third example, due to relative sea level rise, current 1 in 100 year extreme sea level events are projected to occur at least annually in more than half of all tide gauge locations by 2100 under all considered scenarios. As usual, the IPCC report does mention multiple ways in which adaptation and mitigation can affect climate change. All are quite familiar, such as more efficient use of resources, better forest management, carbon capture of fossil fuels, sustainable land use, electric vehicles, and so on. There's never been a problem imagining a net zero carbon world. Here and there, these changes are being accepted. But for every piece of good news, there's an on the other hand. For example, Greenpeace reports that an international group is now putting together a legally binding global plastics treaty. But only a tiny fraction of plastics is being recycled, and more than 170 trillion plastic particles are found in the ocean alone. Then there's alternative energy. As the IPCC reports, from 2010 to 2019, there have been sustained decreases in the unit costs of solar energy, wind energy, and lithium-ion batteries. However, public and private finance flows for fossil fuels are still greater than those for climate adaptation and mitigation. Any wonder why oil and gas company profits are at their highest level ever? BP, for example, reported $28 billion in profits for 2022, and ExxonMobil reported $56 billion in profits. The latest IPCC report was approved by 195 governments and synthesizes the results of countless other scientific reports, as well as summarizes its previous six assessments. Yet many people read them, if at all, as just more dire predictions that are either overly pessimistic or are left to future generations to deal with. Thus, the IPCC contributing authors keep issuing warnings, governments keep making dubious promises, and worsening environmental conditions keep multiplying. We're approaching a tipping point, but no authority exists to stop our passing it. This time, the sky really is falling. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 4th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Harper Simone, Michelle Coppola, Josh Salem, Karen James, and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, and Shantia Hudson. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We're speaking with the Partnership for Safety and Justice about their Oregon legislative agenda.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Oregon Legislature is in session, and among the many bills introduced are bills to reform public safety and the criminal legal system. So here to talk about their legislative agenda